This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When will climate change turn life in the U.S. upside down? What should you do to prepare for the climate change storm? Those are blog titles from Dr. Jeff Masters. Jeff has 45 years of experience as a meteorologist, including 4 years of flying with the famous NOAA Hurricane Hunters. For 20 years, he's blogged about extreme weather and climate change, drawing millions of comments from a worldwide community of weather watchers. Jeff continues as an authoritative source on each big hurricane, but he's not just your standard meteorologist. Recently, Jeff summarized decades of experience to predict how climate change unfolds and what we can do to prepare. Jeff Masters, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Before we dive into your big picture writing, let's just talk about the eerie pause in Atlantic hurricanes. As you know, this summer, NOAA predicted above normal Atlantic hurricanes with 17 to 25 named storms, maybe 4 to 7 possible hurricanes. That has not happened yet. You just posted with Bob Henson about this. As a world expert on hurricanes, Jeff, what do you think is going on?
We don't really know what's going on, which is concerning, gratifying at the same time. We like to see a quiet hurricane season, but this one really has us scratching our heads. And the best thing we can think of is the African monsoon is not behaving as expected. It's actually pushing some record amounts of rainfall up into the Sahara Desert. So all these seedling storms that we usually see coming off the coast of Africa and spawning hurricanes, well, those are going in the Sahara Desert this summer instead. And they're triggering very heavy rains there. And when they come off of the coast of Africa, they're too far north to cause a hurricane, and they're embedded in some Saharan dust and dry air. So very unusual behavior of the African monsoon this year, and we think that's contributed to this quiet period. I mean, normally, first week of September is the busiest whole week of hurricane season, but nada. So what's going on? Well, probably it'll eventually get active again by late September. We saw a similar pause 2 years ago, 2022 hurricane season. We went 0 for August, no named storms at all. But if you recall, that season ended up in late September spawning Hurricane Ian, which hit South Florida and caused $117 billion in damage. So still early, a lot of activity ahead of us, but very unusual things going on in the tropical Atlantic this year.
But as your colleague Bob Henson notes, the Atlantic is quiet for now, but the Pacific is cooking. What have you been watching there?
We've got a tropical storm that hit the Philippines called Yagi, and that is expected to intensify into a major typhoon and hit China, Category 3 or stronger landfall, down to the coast south of Hong Kong there.
We have an unknown canyon yet to explore, an unknown river to run. What falls there may be, we know not. What walls rise over the river, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. And it wasn't at all clear that we could survive it.
I just played a quote from explorer John Wesley Powell as his team set down the unmapped Colorado River rushing through the Grand Canyon. That was 1869, and not everyone survived. Jeff, why open your article on our current situation with that quote?
Because they didn't know what was ahead of them on that famous expedition. It was an unexplored canyon, very forbidding with great depths, and they were getting deeper and deeper into the canyon. And they had to go through rapids of unknown ferocity and face some trials that were unprecedented. The great unknown, they called it. And that's kind of what we face with climate change. We've never experienced this sort of situation in human history. Climate change's challenges are unprecedented. And we don't know what's ahead of us. We know it's going to be turbulent. And we're riding in kind of a primitive boat. I mean, they had these wooden boats that were prone to accidents, and certainly the boat of civilization that we ride in is prone to such problems as well. I mean, you could already say that our boat is leaking and we've got the worst rapids ahead of us. So I thought it was a perfect analogy.
All right, let's go to your first big question titled, When Will Climate Change Turn Life in the U.S. Upside Down? So far, America has managed to cope with life-threatening heat waves and a few historic hurricanes. Is there a point when people are so pummeled by extreme weather, the economy may not recover to so-called normal?
That point has been delayed by throwing money at the problem. I mean, essentially, I make the analogy that when you have a soldier that's wounded, and instead of fixing the underlying injury by putting him in the hospital, you just give him a blood transfusion and send him back to the front lines. So that's kind of what we're doing now. The unsustainable system is being propped up by unwise sorts of spending of money. We're building in unwise, risky places, in flood zones near the coast, on barrier islands, in the wildland-urban interface, in our forests out west, which have been experiencing more intense wildfires that are causing more destruction. And it's simply unsustainable, this sort of mad construction we're doing in risky areas, because there are too many places that we're going to need to defend all at once, too many beach nourishment programs that need to happen, too much federal bailout money is going to be needed to handle all of the increasingly severe disasters we're going to get. And it's very sobering to realize that the steep increase we've seen in disaster costs in recent decades, that's not primarily due to climate change. That's due to unwise building in risky places and for archaic insurance rules that allow us to subsidize building in these foolish places. Climate change is now ramping up, and the relative fraction of damage that is going to be due to climate change is going to severely increase in coming decades. So yes, we're going to rapidly reach the point, I think within 15 years, probably sooner, where we're going to hit the wall of reality, and there's going to be a wholesale reckoning in how we manage our risky places that we're building in.
And the first extremes are already here. Even top scientists are puzzled why so many heat records have been broken in 2023 and 24, and not just by a little, on both land and sea around the world. What do you see as the most imminent climate-driven threats for the United States coming up next, even in the next few years?
The coastal property market is teetering at the brink of insolvency in some regions. It's very difficult to even insure a home in places like Florida, Louisiana, and Texas. And that's going to continue to get worse because sea level rise is flooding the coast more and more, even on sunny days. And when you happen to get a hurricane, its storm surge now can push farther inland because it's riding up on top of higher sea levels. And now with hurricanes getting stronger, at least the strongest ones are getting stronger, you've got a double whammy of coastal damage happening. So the coastal property market is going to have a correction. We're going to see a lot of homes go down in value. A lot of people are going to try and sell. And I think it's likely to trigger a mini great financial crisis of 2008, where you suddenly lose a lot of value in the property market. And that's a systemic sort of threat to the entire economy, as we saw in 2008 with the subprime mortgage crisis. So that's the main threat I see in the near term, and it could happen any year. I mean, it could happen this year if we get unlucky and get another Hurricane Ian-type storm causing $100 billion in damage to the property in Florida. Certainly by the mid-2030s, I think, that threat gets much greater because that's the time when a wobble in the moon's orbit will greatly increase high tide flooding along portions of the U.S. coast, primarily the Gulf Coast, California, and the southeast U.S. coast. So you're going to see a steep ramp up in flooding, and that's going to cause a large amount of pressure in the coastal property market through a large enough stretch of the U.S. that it simply isn't going to be able to sustain the kind of investment and prices we have now.
In your Yale Climate Connections post, you talk about black swan and gray swan extreme weather events. Can you explain a bit?
A black swan is an event we didn't see coming. I mean, not even climate models were able to predict, for instance, the unusual behavior of the jet stream we've seen in recent decades, where it grows in amplitude and freezes in place, bringing us long, extended periods of extreme weather all across the globe. Carmen Mullis are beginning to tell us that, okay, we understand that can happen, but that was a black swan type event. Another black swan event was Hurricane Sandy of 2012. We never knew that a Caribbean hurricane could merge with a mid-latitude cyclone and cause a superstorm like we saw. So crazy sorts of events are expected that we did not see coming, and those are a great concern because we don't know how to model that. Now, a gray swan event, on the other hand, you can think of as something that's unprecedented, but the climate models do see coming. So we have seen some very concerning sorts of runs of the models showing that, hey, we could get a 200-mile-per-hour hurricane hitting one of our major population centers, you know, Miami or Tampa or Houston. That would be maybe even up to a quarter of a trillion-dollar sort of blow to the economy. Also, a mega flood in California costing $1 trillion is something the climate models see as likely to happen in the next 50 years. And there are other gray swans we should anticipate in the future. Certainly, heat waves and droughts that the models are modeling are going to substantially challenge modern civilization, certainly on a global sense, and probably in the U.S. as well.
So when will Earth hit a new normal stage of climate, some plateau where we know what to expect at least?
I hear people ask me a lot, is this the new normal for extreme weather after, you know, crazy summer of extreme weather like we had this year? And I say, this is not the new normal. We will continue getting more extreme in our weather as long as we continue to pump heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, as long as we're not net zero. And the earliest we're going to be net zero under any sort of reasonable sort of climate scenario I'm looking at is the 2070s. So we're talking almost 50 years from now. The weather is going to continue to get more extreme decade after decade after decade. And even when we do stabilize the climate by getting to net zero, not burning any more fossil fuels, sea level rise is going to keep on going because that's got a long sort of tail to it. It'll continue to rise as long as the glaciers are melting, and we've probably reached the point of no return for the glaciers in Greenland, which are going to, over a period of thousands of years or maybe hundreds of years, contribute many feet of sea level rise. And in Antarctica, we're probably pushing the boundary for some of the glaciers there, particularly the ones in the West Antarctica. The Thwaites Glacier and the Pine Island Glacier are going to contribute many feet of sea level rise over a period of a few hundred years.
Your two articles are mainly about the United States, but America is no island in this globalized world. What overseas threats could come back to damage the economy and Americans?
If you've got a synchronized set of heat waves and droughts worldwide that are causing food problems in multiple grain-growing areas, so-called breadbaskets. For instance, Ukraine, Russia has a breadbasket. The United States center also, and Canadian center has a breadbasket. Also, East Asia, China, Vietnam. If you get droughts simultaneously in those three areas that reduce food production, you could get a systemic shock to the global food system that causes prices to spike, and you get political unrest, you get potential war, and it could cause a global economic correction, I mean, to the tune of perhaps $3 trillion, as modeled by Lloyd's of London. They gave a 2.8% chance of a global food shock per year occurring that would cost the global economy $3 trillion. And if you sum that up over a period of 30 years, that's like a 50-50 chance. And that assumes that the risks aren't increasing, which they are, because droughts get more intense as you warm up the climate. So really the odds of a $3 trillion food shock to the global economy are probably better than 50-50 over the next few decades.
And despite deadly heat waves and smashers like Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy, the public and politicians are barely motivated to prepare. Hurricane Sandy flooded Lower Manhattan in New York, some of the most valuable real estate in the world, and they still have not built any defenses for one of the world's most important harbors, and that was in 2012. Should we give up on the idea that the next big storm or wildfire will finally tip the public into real climate action?
You know, there have been so many extreme weather events that should have tipped the balance into making us take climate change seriously. And, I mean, we have done quite a bit. There have been a couple of laws passed in the past 4 years that have given tens of billions of dollars to fight climate change, particularly in response to doing the clean energy revolution, to electrifying the economy. So a lot of progress there, but not so much progress in adaptation to getting ready for what is already here and for what's coming, building our coastal infrastructure stronger, putting money into retreating from risky places, we call it managed retreat, for preparing for more intense wildfires, for our infrastructure, like bridges and dams, being subject to more extremes. We're only spending probably about less than 10% of our total money that we're spending for climate change is going towards what we call adaptation, these sort of things. More than 90% is going towards mitigation, which means emitting less greenhouse gases. So we need to do both. And we're in a reactive than a proactive sense when a big hurricane comes and wipes out, you know, Barrier Island or a major city even. We spend billions to recover from that, but we don't learn from it. We don't get smart to build smarter and stronger rather than just replace what was already there. So I'm not convinced that any disaster is going to change that thinking. And what we're headed for, the future is going to be for unplanned retreat from the coast. It's not going to be managed retreat. We're just going to flee in chaos away from the coast. And there are going to be millions of people, probably as many as 10 million people leaving the coastal region within the next 30 years because of increased climate hazards.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is storm chaser and expert meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters. We go to Jeff's second blog post at Yale Climate Connections. The title is, What Should You Do to Prepare for the Climate Change Storm? So in 2013, I spoke with Jerry Williams. She's a correspondent for EcoShock and Earthbeat Radio. Williams left a job at a local college in Washington, D.C. to move north to Wisconsin. Knowing about global warming, she decided it was time to move her family to a cooler place. It sounded to me early at the time, 2013, but as of August 28, 2024, D.C. has experienced 6 days this summer where the temperature was at least 100 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 38 C. Jeff, talk to us about the hard decisions about whether to move out of foreseeable danger.
The so-called climate havens that people have been reading about are just that. I mean, they're going to be places with cooler temperatures and water. The Great Lakes certainly are a potential climate haven. And they're going to get more and more attractive in the coming decades as the heat increases in the south and drought conditions cause water availability problems. And as people flee the coast from greater coastal storms and sea level rise. So, yes, it makes a lot of sense to leave. But do you leave sooner rather than later? That's a great question because you should consider standing your ground. Because when you leave your place you live, you're away from your web of social connections to your community, and you don't have, you know, your friends and family to help you out. You have your job potentially. So packing your bags is not something you should do lightly. And if you do pack your bags and decide to go, which absolutely you should do, I think, if you live on a barrier island, then where do you go? Well, there are a lot of tools I give in my posts about what you can do to evaluate your risk. But not every place is going to be perfect. I mean, we thought that northern Vermont, for instance, was going to be a climate haven. And if you look at one of the tools I give you, the Climate Vulnerability Index, it's got the least vulnerable mark on there. But yet, if you look at the actual number of FEMA-declared disasters over the past 23 years, northern Vermont has had 10. It ranks the highest on the number of declared disasters in the country, along with other places you might not expect, like Kentucky, and many other places like Louisiana where you would expect it. Every place has risk, and you just have to try and reduce your risk as best you can. And some of the risks are not climate risks either. You got to think about infrastructure. What city that you're moving to has good infrastructure, what has good local government. These are tough tasks to investigate, and you got to do your homework. What's the political situation like? Do they have good people in charge? All these questions need to be answered.
New science and medical research is showing wildfire smoke is much more dangerous for our health than previous generations realized. Last year, massive wildfires in Canada covered most of the northern U.S. with smoke. Jeff, what can we do to protect the health of our families in those cases?
We have to realize there is no safe level of wildfire or smoke concentrations. So you should do what you can to cut down on how much you breathe. And certainly the location you live at is a key place to decide. The western U.S. and western Canada will continue to be hot spots for wildfire activity. So living out there is going to carry hazards during wildfire season, which is getting longer and longer, the whole summer into the fall a lot of times. You need to monitor the air quality levels by consulting in the U.S., the EPA monitors. But it's smart also to put your own home monitor in your backyard. I have one called from purpleair.com that will measure the levels of particle pollution from wildfires. And I look at that all the time to judge my risk. And when it's high, I close up my windows and I turn on my indoor HEPA units. So HEPA units are basically fans attached to filters, and those filters will filter out the wildfire smoke very effectively. And it also will do the same for COVID, airborne viruses. So we're always running HEPA in my house, and we particularly crank it up when there's wildfire smoke outside. And I also have a little home air pollution monitor, just portable, that I can carry around and push the button on top, made by a little company called TempTop, that will give you your air quality index. So I take that around when I'm traveling, or actually when I go up north and camp, I take that unit with me, and I take a little portable HEPA unit with me, too, that I plug into a battery. And inside my tent, I will run my HEPA connected to an air filter to make my air better. So air purification is critical for maintaining your health, and knowing what the air quality is the other thing to be doing.
Believe it or not, I've done that myself. We booked a camping site by a beautiful lake, but you have to book way in advance. When we got there, there were 3 wildfires burning right across the lake, and I had a HEPA air filter and ran it off the solar power in our little RV. So in your review of Abram Lustgarten's book, On the Move, you look at mass migration due to extreme climate changes. In April 2023, I talked with UK science journalist Gaia Vince. She says we are entering a nomad century. There will be so much climate mass migration. Could there be even mass migration within the United States?
There will be mass migration within the United States. There will be tens of millions of people on the move. And mostly this will happen from the coast, from rising sea levels. But it will also happen from hot places, places like Arizona and southern Texas that will get unbearably hot. And it will also come from wildfire zones, places where you basically can't insure a house anymore because of the wildfire risk, or people just don't want to live out there because of the wildfire smoke. So 3 different hazards that will all put people on the move, and it's going to be tough to compete for all the places that people are going to be moving to, these more desirable, cooler places with less wildfire smoke and less flood risk are going to get priced up. And it's going to be kind of a climate gentrification issue where the rich are going to be able to afford to live where all these desirable places are. We're going to need to see a lot of affordable housing built. And this is not on anyone's radar that I see among politicians, the need to build tens of millions of units of affordable housing in some of these climate havens is absolutely something we need to get cracking on right away, and it's not happening. So mass migration is coming. We're not prepared for it, and you'd best be getting ahead of the curve while you can. You know, if you are thinking long-term, moving to a climate haven with affordable housing while you can get it now is a smart thing to do.
So you're still a go-to source for journalists covering the latest weather disaster. I go to Yale Climate Connections when something big happens here. But chronicling the big ones was not enough for you. You turned decades of experience into some warning and some advice, not just for Americans, but this is need-to-know stuff, I think, for anyone, anywhere. Do you feel that you went through a change from pure meteorology to a voice for action?
Absolutely. I've decided I'm going to spend my energy now telling my friends and extended family, I mean, anyone who reads my blog, how to prepare for what's coming, because this is going to be an earth-shaking sort of transition, and it's not going to be a comfortable one. There won't be a seamless transition to a new society in balance with the climate of the 21st century. That's not possible. Had we started in the 1990s, it could have happened, but it's going to be wrenching change, and we really need to be aware of what's coming at us. And so I know as well as anyone what is coming, and what I know is still highly inadequate. It's so many unknowns because human behavior is involved, politics is involved, weather and climate are involved. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. There's a lot to take in. You should educate yourself as best you can on what's coming.
You do find some hope for the future in something called cathedral thinking. Let's wrap up with that. Tell us more.
We have to realize that what's coming at us, I think of as kind of, we rate hurricanes on a scale of 1 to 5, okay? So we talk a lot about when we pass 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming, 2 centigrade of warming, 3 centigrade of warming over pre-industrial levels, what that means. I think of, for humanity, once we cross that 1.5 degree centigrade threshold, that's like a Category 1 hurricane for humanity. When we cross the 2-degree threshold, which will probably occur around 2050, that's like a Category 3 hurricane. That'll be devastating. I mean, it's going to cause tremendous destruction, loss of life. And we need to really hold global warming below 3 degrees centigrade of warming, which I think of as catastrophic. So I don't think we have any choice. We're going to have to hold global warming below 3 degrees centigrade or all is lost. I think that we're already in a place where we've laid the foundation of the new society we need to have in order for that to happen. That's the clean energy revolution. And we have to realize that this revolution we've started isn't something that's going to be finished in our lifetime. I mean, the cathedrals of the Middle Ages, those were multi-decade, sometimes lasted more than a century projects. So the people that are building our cathedral of the future, the clean energy society with zero emissions in balance with the new climate, we're not going to live to see that cathedral finished. But the cornerstone has been laid. We have the clean energy revolution in place, and we just have to keep building on that. And we have to contribute. Everybody's got to do their part, lay their brick, contribute to what we need to build. And there are a lot of people that have great suggestions on what you can do. Certainly, talking about climate change and getting people more aware of what's coming at us is important. Joining a climate action group is important. Supporting politicians and leaders that will do something about it. All these things need to happen. And that's how you can make your unique contribution. And obviously, reducing your carbon footprint is important. Traveling less, eating lower on the food chain, a vegan diet. All these things are things you can do to contribute to building our cathedral of the future. It's got to happen. I think it will happen. We're not going to reach a science fiction future where, you know, it'll be this post-apocalyptic thing like a Blade Runner or a Waterworld. We're going to fall short of that. We're going to make it happen. We're going to come through the climate crisis, but it's going to take 50-plus years. The weather's going to keep on getting more extreme for that long. So it's important now to elect leaders that will help make that happen. The next election cycle in the U.S. is critical for that. So buckle up. We've got a raft to ride through the rapids of unknown intensity, and keep the faith. We're a lot of very smart, talented people working on this. We're going to pull through.
Jeff Masters co-founded Weather Underground in 1995. He was a flight meteorologist for NOAA. Take time to explore Jeff's recent post at yaleclimateconnections.org. And you can find links to follow up as well in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you so much for coming back for our listeners.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Alex.
The quote from explorer John Wesley Powell was read by American actor Clay Jenkinson for National Geographic.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.